With its relentless airstrikes and shelling of the besieged Gaza Strip, as the death toll from the genocidal war surpasses 33,000. The founder of a U.S.-based charity whose convoy of aid workers was recently targeted in Gaza says the Israeli attack was systematic and purposeful. And Iran criticizes the U.S. and France for blocking a U.N. Security Council statement to condemn the Israeli strike on the Iranian embassy in Syria.
Well, welcome to the studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is Muse. Thanks for joining us.
Nearly 6 months into the Israeli genocidal war in Gaza, the regime keeps pressing ahead with its onslaught across the besieged strip. Some 62 Palestinians have been killed, and scores more injured in Israeli airstrikes and shelling over the past 24 hours. The regime forces also continued their aerial raids on the city of Khan Yunis in southern Gaza. They say that the majority of these attacks were focused on the Al-Amal neighborhood, leaving a number of people dead. Meanwhile, Palestinian fighters are putting stiff resistance to Israeli troops on the ground in some areas. They have attacked Israeli soldiers and vehicles with mortars in the eastern and the southern parts of Gaza City. According to the Gaza Health Ministry, the death toll from the Israeli war has now topped 33,000. Over 75,600 Palestinians have also been wounded, while thousands more remain unaccounted for. Israel is facing denunciation over the killing of international aid workers associated with the U.S.-based charity World Central Kitchen. The head of the NGO says the Israeli regime is responsible for the death of his staff in Gaza. We earlier discussed the issue in our news review program. Let's take a listen.
News review, where we look deeper into some of the top stories of the day. On this segment of the program, the founder of the U.S.-based charity World Central Kitchen has criticized Israel over the killing of his staff in Gaza, saying the regime's forces systematically targeted a convoy carrying aid workers. Jose Andres said that cars were hit purposefully, one after the other, in a civilian area under the control of the Israeli army. He held Israel responsible for the killing, which he said was not the outcome of a bad luck situation. He added the Israeli forces were well informed about the convoy's movement and that the cars were clearly marked with the charity's logo. The strike killed 6 foreign aid workers and their Palestinian translator. 60% of non-governmental aid getting into the besieged strip is from the World Central Kitchen. The charity has suspended its operations in Gaza following the attack. Joining us on this edition of the News Review, we have journalist and commentator Tashrich Trubadi joining us from Cape Town, also a member of the Kenya-Palestine Solidarity Movement. Booker Ngessa is joining us from Nairobi. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Trubadi in Cape Town. The Israelis, since this Gaza genocide started, have killed around 200 aid workers. That is no accident, is it?
It isn't. And there's a couple of issues, I think, with the way in which the story is also being covered, in that it, of course, is an absolute tragedy. I have no doubt that these aid workers were good souls. They were good human beings that had been determined to bring relief to Palestinians that are having to endure a genocide at the moment in Gaza. And while their death, as in any death, is a tragedy, I do think we need to contrast the Western government responses here to the realities that Palestinian lives are not quite as equally important, in the outrage that we're now seeing here from some of these governments. These governments, of course, also now finding their voice because of the domestic responses in some of these countries that are increasingly now leading to a push for not just a ceasefire, but holding these governments accountable for funding and propping up the Zionist entity. So there's a very serious and a big worry about the manner in which the humanity of the Palestinians aren't quite seen as much as we've now seen with these aid workers. I do think there was an agenda here with this particular attack, especially as we increasingly now talking about a potential escalation with boots on the ground in Rafah. So I think it was more than deliberate. It was seeking to send a message.
Right, and let's cross over to Mr. Ngessa. As we were mentioning in our intro, around 60% of non-governmental aid getting into the besieged strip was reported to be from the World Central Kitchen. As a result of the attack, the charity has suspended its operations in Gaza. Is that what the Israelis were aiming for?
First of all, the situation in Gaza is very dire. The famine situation is very, very dire. And this is because this is not a natural disaster, but it is a situation that has been artificially created by the Israel regime. And within its policy of even, you know, attacking humanitarian organizations who dare to correct, the famine has been caused by the genocidal attacks on Gaza. The Zionist regime, who is actually not just complicit, but advancing the policy of genocide against Palestinian people, do not want aid to reach where it is needed.
Thank
most.
You, gentlemen. That was Bukhari Nguessa, a member of the Kenya-Palestine Solidarity Movement, joining us from Nairobi. And thanks to journalist and commentator Tashreeq Truebody, speaking to us from Cape Town. With that, it brings us to an end here on this edition of the News Review.
The spokesman of the Al-Quds Brigades, the military wing of the Islamic Jihad movement, says the resistance is determined to continue the Al-Aqsa flood operation until final victory. Imam Hamza said the resistance operations on the ground reflect its full rejection of the Israeli plan to occupy the Gaza Strip. He added the axis of resistance is now repelling the Israeli regime's attacks in Gaza, the West Bank, and in Lebanon. In a statement released on Thursday, the Al-Quds Brigade said it had targeted two Israeli contingents in the southern city of Khan Yunis. Some Israeli military equipment and vehicles, including a tank and a drone, were also hit in the same city. The Israeli military has already confirmed the death of nearly 260 of its troops since the regime's ground invasion of Gaza. Palestinian groups, however, say that the regime is hiding the actual number of its casualties in order to avoid public anger. A senior Hamas representative in Lebanon has slammed Israeli atrocities in the Gaza Strip, calling on Palestinians to escalate acts of resistance against the regime. Osama Hamdan said in a press conference that all plans of the enemy against Gaza will be destroyed in the face of Palestinian resistance. He also mentioned the Israeli attack on charity workers in Gaza, saying that the strike shows the depth of Israel's brutality as the regime keeps violating all international norms and laws. The senior Hamas official condemned the continued U.S. support for Israel, saying that Washington is responsible for Tel Aviv's crimes against Palestinians. On the notion of talks for a possible ceasefire, he stressed that any deal must lead to an end to the onslaught on Gaza and the withdrawal of Israeli forces from the territory. Speaking on the eve of International Quds Day, Hamdan called for worldwide rallies in solidarity with the Palestinian people. Israel's top military intelligence official resigns after taking full responsibility for the failure of the regime's intelligence apparatus in countering Al-Aqsa flood operation on October 7. Amit Sar was head of Amman's research division. He cited illness as the reason for his early resignation. However, Israeli authorities have pushed the majority of the blame for the failure to intercept the events of October 7, 2023 on intelligence officials. Sar had previously expressed his readiness to relinquish his duties once the Israeli war on Gaza was over. At least two other officials have also left their positions vacant in the Israeli military intel system since the Palestinian resistance Al-Aqsa flood operation. International Quds Day is an annual pro-Palestinian event marked on the last Friday of the holy month of Ramadan. The day was designated by the founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran, Imam Khomeini, back in 1979, in solidarity with Palestinians. People worldwide will mark this year's Quds Day on the coming Friday. A correspondent in Belfast, Dieter Reinisch, has asked some people there about the event and its importance to the Palestinian cause. Let's take a listen.
I think that the Iranian government choosing such a symbolic day as the last Friday in Ramadan as Al-Quds Day and as a day of celebrating solidarity with the Palestinians really shows that solidarity with Palestine is their number one foreign policy priority and has been since the revolution. So I think that Palestinians, especially in these days in midst of war, starvation and genocide, will treasure this act of solidarity more than in any year before.
And I believe fully that the Israeli ambassador should be expelled from Ireland. I believe that everyone has a right to protest and should be on the streets calling for this genocide, this mass murder, not only to be stopped, but we should be calling for Netanyahu to be in The Hague, and the International War Crimes Committee should be taking him for the crimes against humanity that he has created in Gaza. As I said, one thing to murder innocent people with bombs and with bullets, but to use hunger, starvation and famine as a way of murdering and wiping out innocent men, women and children is abhorrent and is the worst crime in humanity in a long, long time.
It is definitely genocide caused by the Zionists, definitely. And it didn't happen on the 7th of October. This has been going on for years. Israel, the Palestinians have been living in an open prison for years and years. And I think it's ridiculous that the West isn't seeing what's happening. Well, they are seeing it, but they're doing nothing about it. And that's what's so frustrating for the people to watch all these children, men, women, wee boys, not getting murdered.
I think it's absolutely disgraceful. That the West acts like it does, that the West funds this terrorism. I call it terrorism because that's exactly what it is. It's been terrorism for the last 75 years in Palestine.
Iran's Basij volunteer forces have held naval drills in the southern waters of the country to mark International Quds Day. More than 3,000 types of vessels and motorboats have participated in the naval exercise held by the maritime units of Basij in support of the Palestinian people and resistance. The drill was held over an area from the Arvand River in the Persian Gulf to the Sea of Oman. The parade of the vessels was under the command of the IRGC Navy. Simultaneous drills were also scheduled to be held by resistance groups in Iraq, Syria, Yemen, and Lebanon. Iran criticizes the U.S., Britain, and France for blocking a U.N. Security Council statement to condemn the Israeli strike on the Iranian embassy in Syria. In a social media post, Iran's permanent mission to the U.N. called the move double standard and said it undermined the credibility of the Security Council. It also said the blocking set dangerous precedents. Earlier, Russia said that Washington and London refused to discuss the draft statement on the Iranian embassy attack. On Tuesday, most Security Council members, except the U.S., Britain, France, condemned the Israeli regime for its airstrike on the Iranian embassy. Monday's attack killed two senior Iranian military commanders and five accompanying officers who were on an advisory mission to Syria. Iranians in several cities across the country, including the capital Tehran, have held anti-Israeli, anti-U.S. protests as well after several Iranian generals and officers were killed in an Israeli attack in Syria. Protesters demanded decisive response and revenge for the deadly strike on Iran's embassy in Damascus. Fatima Masumi reports.
Iranians took to the streets of the capital Tehran and gathered at iconic Palestine Square at midnight after the deadly Israeli attack on Iran's embassy in Syria. They chanted death to the Israeli regime and death to America as they waved Palestine flags. The protesters expressed their support for Palestinian people in Gaza as Israel's genocidal war continues unabated.
When we heard what has happened, we couldn't tolerate it, and we came here for the sake of our martyrs. Our Muslim brothers and sisters, Palestinians, Syrians, are all a part of our own nation, and there's no difference between us.
Two of our generals were martyred, so we have gathered here to show our readiness for retaliation. We are asking the Islamic Republic of Iran to take serious action against these atrocities and the disrespect towards our nation and also the innocent Palestinians.
On Monday, Iran's ambassador to Damascus, Hossein Akbari, confirmed that Brigadier General Mohammad Reza Zahedi and his deputy Mohammad Hadi Haji Rahimi were killed in the Israeli attack.
It is our duty to come out because we felt that even though the resistance movement is showing patience towards the Israeli regime, we are still witnessing that the regime is pressing ahead with its atrocities, with the recent incident of the attack on the Iranian consulate.
The attack came as almost 6 months into the Gaza hostilities, the regime has failed to achieve its objectives of destroying Hamas, despite killing tens of thousands of Palestinians, mostly women and children. The two slain Iranian generals had been comrades of top Iranian anti-terror commander General Qasem Soleimani, who was also assassinated in an attack in January 3, 2020. General Soleimani played a key role in fighting and decimating the Daesh Takfiri terrorist group in the region, particularly in Iraq and Syria.
A large number of people have gathered here in Palestine Square to strongly condemn the recent Israeli attack on the Iranian consulate in the capital of Syria, Damascus. Fatem Asumi, Tehran.
The running president says the Israeli regime will pay a heavy price for its criminal act of attacking the consular section of Iran's embassy in the Syrian capital. Ibrahim Raisi made the remarks in a phone conversation with the Iraqi Prime Minister, Mohammad Shia al-Sudani. He described the terrorist act of the Zionist regime as a clear violation of principles of international law governing diplomatic and consular relations. While hailing the pro-Palestine stance of Tehran and Baghdad, Raisi emphasized the need for all Islamic countries to adopt the same approach. Sudani, for his part, denounced Israeli aggression and said that such criminal act was the result of the constant failures of the occupying regime in the battle against regional resistance forces. He further expressed gratitude for the unwavering support of Iran for efforts to establish peace and stability in Iraq. Iranian officials say the clashes between security forces and terrorists in the southeastern province of Sistan and Balochistan have concluded. The IRGC ground forces said 18 assailants were killed following the attacks in the cities of Rasht and Chabahar late on Wednesday night. 10 Iranian security forces also lost their lives. According to the IRGC, the terrorists carried out 5 simultaneous attacks against police and military posts in the southeastern province. Local officials said the terrorists were affiliated with Pakistan-based Jaish-e-Lat terror outfit that had carried out several similar attacks in the past. The group claimed responsibility for an attack back in December on a police station in Rask that killed at least 11 officers in January. Another attack by the group left the policeman dead. And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The Zionist regime military has withdrawn from the Gaza Strip's largest hospital after a two-week raid, leaving behind scenes of devastation. Hundreds of people returned to Ashifa Hospital and the surrounding area after the withdrawal recently. They reported finding bodies strewn inside and outside the facility. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. The Palestine Chronicle spoke with 3 eyewitnesses, including 2 journalists, who were met with scenes of absolute devastation when they reached the vicinity of the Ashifa Hospital. At dawn, April 1st, Israeli occupation forces suddenly withdrew from the Ashifa medical complex following a 2-week siege and constant attacks. When they learned about the withdrawal, Gaza City residents converged on the area west of Gaza City to survey the damage caused by the Zionist regime incursion and to assess the conditions of their homes, which they were forced to evacuate. What they encountered was shocking. Palestinian journalist Badr Abdul Allah told the Palestine Chronicle, "Everything in the complex is destroyed. All the buildings of the hospital were bombed and are no longer usable." He noted, "The Ashifa Medical Complex is the largest hospital in the Gaza Strip, and it is the lifeline of the health sector in Gaza." Adel Al told Palestine Chronicle, "But now it is destroyed, and the occupation has completely taken it out of service. Israel must be held accountable for the crimes it committed in Ashifa." He continued,
All media outlets documented the crimes throughout these months, and they are still there. This crime, however, cannot pass without accountability. The occupation has violated everything in the Gaza Strip, and nobody in the world seems to be determined to stop them. Rather, major global powers are complicit and partners in massacring our Palestinian people. Ayman Hatou is another journalist who witnessed the degree of devastation left behind by the Israeli regime army. He compared the obliteration to what he saw last November when Israeli regime forces stormed the complex for the first time. Hatou told the Palestine Chronicle, "In November, the destruction was confined to the external areas and only part of the building were damaged," he added. "We did not expect all of this. This time, the Israeli army left destruction and devastation in all the buildings of the complex. They were all bombed and burnt. There is no usable building or floor," Hatou noted. "The scene that appeared in front of us this morning was like the destruction caused by the Mongols who invaded Iraq hundreds of years ago. This time around, however, everything was documented by cameras. It is crystal clear that the Israeli army is the most unethical army in the world. They have no red lines." Abu Anas al-Shanshiri is a resident of Gaza City. His son Anas and his daughter Aisha were killed nearly 3 months ago by an Israeli regime strike, and their bodies were buried in the courtyard of Ashafa. He told the Palestine Chronicle, "I couldn't find a place to bury them at that time. We were forced to bury them in the medical complex, and I used to visit their graves regularly." Ashan Shiri hoped that the bodies remained there so that he could bury them in a cemetery after the end of the war. He said, "When I learned that the occupation had stormed Ashafa 2 weeks ago, I followed the news obsessively. My biggest fear was that they would dig up graves and remove bodies from the courtyard. But when I rushed there this morning, the destruction and devastation I witnessed cannot be described. If an earthquake had struck the complex, it would have been less devastating than the ruins left by the occupation." Al-Shanshiri reached the place where his son and daughter were buried, only to find a hole amid the rubble and the destruction. He said in tears, "I couldn't find the bodies of my children, and I could not locate their whereabouts." He continued, "Perhaps the occupation forces took them, or perhaps their bulldozers swept them away and moved them under the rubble to other places in the complex. I'm still searching, hoping to find them. The atrocities they committed in Ashafa, including my digging up graves, are simply unspeakable." Meanwhile, Press TV reported the Gaza Health Ministry says Israeli forces have withdrawn tanks and vehicles from Gaza's main hospital, Ashifa, after a two-week siege of the medical complex. In a statement recently, the ministry said dozens of bodies, some of them decomposed, had been found at the complex after the Zionist regime pulled out, which also left behind a vast swath of destruction. It emphasized that Israel retreated from the hospital after burning down the complex buildings and putting it completely out of service, the ministry said. "The scale of the destruction inside the complex and the buildings around it is very large. All buildings in the hospital were exposed to fire or sustained damage, including the mortuary and the hospital's courtyards and corridors." The Israeli regime military also confirmed withdrawal from the hospital. The Gaza government's media office said dozens of Israeli airstrikes and shells around the complex have provided cover for the withdrawing vehicles. The Zionist regime first raided the hospital in Gaza City last November. On March 18th, Israeli occupation forces started a new wave of attacks on the medical complex and imposed a siege on it. Ashifa, Gaza's largest hospital, has sheltered thousands of Palestinians who fled Israel's invasion in the northern parts of the territory. The Zionist regime military claimed that the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas is using the facility to conduct and promote territory activity. Hamas has repeatedly denied operating from Ashifa and other health facilities. A doctor said more than 20 bodies had been recovered from Ashifa Hospital and that some had been crushed by withdrawing vehicles. The Zionist regime unleashed its brutal U.S.-backed war on the Gaza Strip on October 7th after Hamas carried out a historic operation against a usurping entity in retaliation for the regime's intensified atrocities against the Palestinian people. However, more than 6 months into the offensive, the Tel Aviv regime has failed to achieve its objectives of destroying Hamas and finding Israeli captives, despite killing at least 32,782 Palestinians, mostly women and children, and injuring 75,298 others. Around 1.4 million people who fled their homes elsewhere in Gaza have sought shelter in Rafah, the only part of the territory Israeli troops have yet to enter. Washington has nonetheless approved billions of dollars worth of bombs and fighter jets for Israel in recent days, the Wall Street Journal reported, citing unnamed officials.
Hidden Files. But do you condemn Hamas? This has been mainstream media's favorite question ever since Hamas's preemptive strike on occupied Palestine on October the 7th. But sadly for them, they're no longer the only media that people get their news from. After some 75 years of the ongoing genocide in Palestine, the journalists on the ground were finally able to get their voice across to people all over the world and to inform them of the bombings that have killed tens of thousands of Palestinians, mostly women and children. And that's when October 7th could no longer justify the ongoing genocide, even in the minds of former supporters of the Israeli regime. Now, many have already realized that mainstream media blamed Hamas to buy more time for the Zionist regime to murder as many Palestinians as they could and to occupy as much land as possible. But the question remains, from a legal perspective, who is responsible for the thousands of lives lost, especially since October the 7th? Hello, I'm Marzieh Hashimi, and this is Hidden Files. This is the discussion that we will have today with lawyer and doctor of jurisprudence and human rights activist Stanley Cohen. Stay tuned, please.
Stanley Cohen is an American lawyer and human rights activist. Following graduation from college, Stanley started working as a VISTA volunteer and helped set up legal service projects in Native American reservations. Cohen then went on to work as a community organizer to tackle the issues of homeless teens and later as an administrator in a federally funded anti-poverty agency. He then went on to law school to defend human rights on a legal level and earned a doctorate of jurisprudence. Since then, he has worked on various lawsuits, from those taking on the NSA spying program to others involving false accusations targeting various minorities and individuals. Defending Patrice Lumumba against accusations of the material support of terrorism, and defending the Hamas political leader against extradition by the Israeli regime. Due to his success in various such legal projects, Stanley Cohen has for long been a target for smearing campaigns and various threats which he has survived to date.
Well, thank you so much, Stanley Cohen, for being with us. I'd like to start off with mainstream media's favorite question. Do you condemn Hamas? And what are the legal definitions of their actions according to law?
I like to respond to that question with, who did you pick on before Hamas from, you know, 1936 to 1985? The mainstream media likes to use Hamas as the convenient boogeyman, likes to use any quote-unquote Islamist movement, even one that's overseeing, with all the difficulties, the civil society that was voted into office. But it's always Hamas, Hamas, Hamas. So they look to October 7th, and they completely ignore the history of Israeli genocide, Israeli ethnic cleansing, Israeli war crimes, Israeli crimes against humanity, and they say it's Hamas. Do I condemn Hamas? No. Hamas is a national liberation movement that has been in the forefront of the resistance since 1985. It has a leadership that is highly educated, sophisticated, learned, committed to their people from Gaza. These are not people that one day got on a plane and came from Brooklyn, as the Zionists are, to some foreign country. These are people that grew up in Gaza, many of whom the leadership left over a number of years to pursue education elsewhere, received doctorate degrees. They're academics, they're scholars, they're lawyers, they're scientists, they're producers, they're directors, they're artists, and return home to help to liberate Palestine. So do I condemn Hamas? No.
Well, let's talk a little bit about you, because you've represented many people who couldn't afford to pay you along the way. And I mean, given your expertise and your experience, you could have had a lot more money. Why did you choose a different path?
I recently had a discussion with a journalist who asked me the same question. I said, well, you know, I'm sure Henry Kissinger did not get to take his money with him. I'm sure Bill Gates will not be able to take his money with him. We have to make choices in life. Is it about the pursuit of profit? Is it about the pursuit of power? Is it about political control? Or is it about being part of a world community that's here for a very limited period of time, since that they too were not going to spend their lives pursuing money, but pursuing justice?
Well, why did you, you've decided to represent a lot of Hamas officials and other groups too, although there would be repercussions for you? Why is that the case?
Well, I had, years before I represented Abu Marzouk, who was one of the founders of Hamas and was the original head of the political wing and is now still a major senior leader of the movement, I had been involved in supporting Palestinian self-determination, Palestinian independence, Palestinian liberation as a young lawyer. I organized some political actions. I was involved as an attorney representing people that were protesting against Israel years before even Hamas evolved. I had a very active role in a Muslim in the Islamic community in the United States, not trying to singularize it, because obviously it's a community of diversity with different priorities and back. Through my work representing many dozens of Albanian Muslims who were charged with various situations in the United States, and who eventually, as a result of negotiations, went to Bosnia and joined the KLA with the approval of the United States, in essence fighting before the United States dragged NATO in, before the bombings occurred. That connected me in a different light to the Muslim community in the United States in general, and to the Palestinian community in particular. And then one day when I had just finished a very long trial and was getting ready to go on holiday for a few weeks, I got a call from the leaders of one of these organizations who asked me if I could go to the federal prison, that there was a gentleman who had been picked up suddenly on an immigration hold, someone who was a lawful resident in the United States. And I really I was too tired and I couldn't do it. And I recommended other lawyers. And then as an aside, I said, well, who is this person? And then he mentioned a name to me, and the name didn't mean anything to me at the time. And he said, Musa Abu Marzouk. And I said, who was that? And then he said, well, I said, no, I'm tired. I need to get away. I've got family and friends that are expecting me. We've got a cabin on the ocean. And then he said, well, he's the head of Mas. And I went, oh, okay. So I called my family and I said, look, you're going to have to do what you have to do on your own. I've got to go see this gentleman. And I went to meet Abu Marzouk, and we spent a day or half a day talking. And I'll never forget, he looked at me when I walked in, and he said, looked up and down at me, up and down. I had, my hair was all over the place, and I had ripped dungarees on, and I had a sweatshirt on that said, the first thing we do, quoting Shakespeare, we'll kill all the lawyers. And he looked at me, and he said, who are you? And I told him, I used a certain term that I'd, a phrase that I'd been told to use to give him comfort that I wasn't there as a representative of the government. I'd been sent friends. And I used it. And he said, well, who are you? As he stared at me up and down, amazed, and looked at me. And I said, well, I'm a lawyer. And he looked at me up and down. And he said, you're a lawyer? He said, I don't need a lawyer. And I said, you're right. You don't need one lawyer. You need a dozen lawyers. And he laughed. And he said, sit down. And I did. And that was the beginning of probably 1,000 hours worth of one-on-one discussions that he and I had over the next 2 years. While we fought his case initially, it was for a removal order from the United States, and then the Knesset, an unprecedented act, issued an arrest warrant and demanded his extradition to Israel to stand trial for the Intifada. We became very close over the course of 2 years. And Abu Marzouk is not just a founder, a framer, and the original head of the political wing of Hamas. He's a brilliant political scientist. He's a brilliant internationalist. He's a travel gentleman who has, and still does, obviously, tremendous experience in politics and reality and history. He understands.
Wow, it's quite interesting, quite beautiful. I want to look at, if you give me permission, ask you a question about your Twitter account or X, because you have a profile picture of two Hamas leaders there. I'd like to know why you have chosen that picture for your profile picture.
Sheikh Ahmed was a friend. I had the privilege and the pleasure of spending time with him, being hosted by him in Gaza on 5 or 6 occasions before he was assassinated. Abu Shanab was a dear friend. I spent a lot of time with Abu Shanab. In fact, the car in which he was assassinated was by an Israeli rocket. I had been in that car just 4 or 5 days before he had been murdered, going to an interview. And to show you the kindness, the support, the love of the Palestinian community in general in my relationship with it, I had left Gaza. I was handling a case in California. I think it was early in the morning. I was asleep and my phone rang. And it was Abu Shanab's wife who told me she was giving me her condolences. She told me that Abu Shanab had been assassinated several hours before, and she wanted to give her condolences to me, his wife of decades, the mother of his children, because she knew how close we were. We were very close. Whenever I would go to Gaza, I would spend hours and days with Abu Shanab. He'd be my escort. He was a professor of engineering at the Islamic University in Gaza. He was educated, got his PhD in the United States. He was very close friends with Abu Marzouk. We hit it off right away. And I can think of no better way of honoring the memory of these two great warriors, these two wonderful, dynamic, principled fighters for justice and human rights.
Well, there are those who talk about Hamas on October the 7th and the legality as we are in the middle of this Israeli genocide. I mean, I'd like to hear your perspective based on international law regarding both sides of this current situation.
Under international law, an occupying force, an occupying state is permitted to maintain the de minimis or the minimum amount of security apparatus until there's a resolution as to the occupation. And that may mean small military outposts. That may mean the presence of occupying military or security forces. It does not permit the introduction of, as they have here, some 800,000 largely European colonialist Jews into the West Bank, It does not permit the theft of land and the establishment of so-called settlements. It does not permit for the building of walls. It does not permit for the establishment of infrastructure, of economy, of an infrastructure, a system that is comparable basically to a city. It doesn't permit it. And what they do, Israel, again, in going one step further, they decided because it's quote-unquote a military zone, then people that have been in the military zone for for thousands of years, are not entitled to due process of the occupying state. They're not entitled to get access to Israeli courts. And as we've seen for years now, even those Israelis going through the Israeli court system are denied any real modicum of justice, due process, and equal protection with a system of government in which the Knesset can largely overrule what the court system wants to do. So what they've done is they've established this military system. It's staffed by military judges, by military security people out of uniform, are not civilians. Israeli police out of uniform are not civilians. Settlers that are carrying weapons are not civilians. Settler outposts that have heavy-duty weapons is not a civilian outpost. So there's that whole definition. But clearly, children, the elderly, the infirm are civilian under international law and should not be removed. But the problem that we have is not knowing who did what, when, where, why, or how. That's with just competing narratives. But when we talk about competing narratives, there's no debate over what's going on in Gaza. There's no debate what's been going on in Palestine for 75, 80, 85 years, even before the United Nations crafted Israel. Response to that is, Israel, proved your case. The International Criminal Court ruled in 2021 that it has jurisdiction not just over Palestine because it's a signatory to the Rome Statute.
Well, I can't believe we're still watching this murder take place on a daily basis. What can be done to stop this genocide immediately, in your perspective?
The ICC has enough probable cause and has enough evidence to issue arrest warrants for Netanyahu and a dozen of his top advisors. That immediately limits their ability to travel. That immediately sends a message to people that want to come there to meet with them, conspire with them. That raises the accountability and the concern, because that really sends the message, okay, you are a suspected criminal. There is an arrest warrant for you. We're going to file it with Interpol. There is some standing for the notion that assets can be frozen, which Iran is well versed in, although it's been used up. Not legally against Iran over the years, but as a political weapon. Assets can be frozen. Organizations, private entities that are now providing money, that are now providing weapons, that are now providing technical support to the Israeli government are on notice that you are if you continue, you may yourselves be involved in criminal wrongdoing. The General Assembly can ask the ICJ for an immediate recommendation. There is universal jurisdiction in many countries in this world. Claims can be brought. They've been started already in South Africa, which is similar to the ICC to the extent that they have the power to issue arrest warrants based upon probable cause. Red notices are set with Interpol. In states themselves, for example, in the United States, there can be an effort. There should be lobbying and political effort to impose the Arms Export Control Act, which would freeze funding and weapons for Israel. There are domestic jurisdiction issues where if I'm a Palestinian and I have Palestinian American or Palestinian who happens to be in the United States right now, who has family, businesses, homes, etc., that have been destroyed, who have been executed, that have been victimized by war crimes, they can attempt to bring domestic actions in domestic courts under U.S. law. There's an issue of what's called extraterritoriality, which has to do with the ability of U.S. courts to reach out for activity and conduct overseas directed at U.S. But keep in mind, the U.S. has had more than a few examples over the years of Palestinian American citizens, including famed journalists, that have been executed by Israel, and the Department of Justice has done nothing in the United States. So again, there's that double standard. So there is an ability to move the ICC to bring an advisory opinion action in the International Court of Jurisdiction of Justice, for universal jurisdictions to file arrest warrants for Netanyahu and other leaders of the military, to begin to identify businesses. And we know there have been lawsuits in the United States that have gone after tax-exempt organizations that provide money illegally that are tax-exempt to so-called settlements in the occupied West Bank, in the Palestinian territories. So there is a combination of actions which can be brought domestically and internationally, which can be saying to Israel, enough. But at this point, there have been 20,000 Palestinians who have lost their lives, almost all of them civilians, 60% of them children, 75% of Gaza is in ruins, 1.5 million people have been displaced, no food, no water, no electricity, no medical attention. Who knows what viruses and illnesses and plagues are going to befall. But again, this is not inadvertent. This is a determined effort, a designed plan that Israel has been waiting to unleash, and it has.
Yeah, it's absolutely unbelievable, mind-boggling what is taking place and how everyone is watching it. I mean, based on this international rules-based community that exists right now, do you think that this same community then will actually play a role in stopping this genocide?
I'm not waiting for the world community to all of a sudden grow principle of justice and independence and to move on behalf of a targeted people. If for that, you know, we will be generations away. But I am optimistic that the combination of movement at the ICC, movement at universal jurisdictions, but most important, millions of young, largely young women and men worldwide in the streets, demonstrating, the BDS movement expanding, Israeli military factories and plants that are providing information being demonstrated against, civil disobedience there. There have been acts of criminal mischief as well. So I think this combination, and keep in mind, I'm not naive. I don't believe that Biden or the West or anyone is going to step in until after Israel has been able to accomplish the next step of its never-ending Nakba that it's designed to do. But I think they're reaching, and they're not going to step in out of principle or out of purpose or out of passion or out of love or out of humanity. But it's going to reach a point where politically it's boomeranging back against them, and that's when they're going to step in. But meanwhile, the fact that Netanyahu has been given a green light, I mean, now he's invading the south. They displaced 1.5 million people in the north and the center of Gaza and sent them down basically to the south. And now the tanks are rolling into the south and there's no defense. And there's hundreds, if not thousands, of Palestinians, civilians, again, being slaughtered every day. There are variables, and I'm not suggesting or proposing that Hezbollah or Syria or anyone else continue their involvement or expand it. But that's an issue. Using the old anecdote, the colloquialism, the 800-pound gorilla in the China shop, there's increasing tension and fighting going on with Hezbollah in the north. Syria is pushing back again. I suspect the West Bank is going to explode. The real issue is, I think there's going to come a point in time. Let us not forget, this is as much about Netanyahu trying to save himself from a judicial process that he's under indictment, I believe, in 2 or 3 cases, and the trials are beginning again. In Netanyahu's mind, as long as he can say we're at war, we're at war, we're at war, we're at war, he's safe. In the minds of the Kahanists that now run the military, the industrial military complex, the security state, as long as they get to say, see what they did to us, us, they're allowed to expand, they're allowed to justify increasing violent expansion of so-called settlements. I don't know how it's going to play out at this point.
Right.
But one thing is for sure, that resolution, meanwhile, is thousands of Palestinian lives are being lost to the lust, the political lust, not just of Israel, but the proxy masters of the West that have been involved in this situation. And it's not just the West. I look at UAE, I look at Bahrain, I look at Saudi Arabia, I look at Morocco, I look at other Arab states or Gulf states that have been complicit throughout. I look at the fact that we had to beg Egypt to open Rafah even periodically for goods and services to come in. And meanwhile, says, yes, we'll let Rafah should be open so that we can displace a million Palestinians. Egypt, you deal with it. Push them off into the Sinai. Let's send the Bedouin back to the desert. So we have complicity among certain states in the region. And then we have other states that have long supported Palestine. Iran is one. Doha, Qatar has been there. Algeria has been there. South Africa and African states have been there. So we've got this tension that's underway right now, and I'd like to be able to predict with some modicum of certainty how it's going to end up, but I really can't at this point.
Well, Stanley, I'd like to hear your final comments about the overall situation.
Is very clear on what's going on in Palestine. I think the world community, especially the young women and men of the world community, need to stay in the streets, need to demonstrate, need to engage in all sorts of activities against governments, need to make sure that the political leadership understand there's a price to pay for their blind, obedient support for Israeli genocide. I send my love and solidarity to the Palestinian people. They know they are loved. They know they have support. We will fight with them. We will work with them. We will struggle with them. We will never forget we are family.
Stanley Cohen, it's been a pleasure having you right here on Hidden Files. I'd like to welcome my colleague, Maryam Azadcher, to Hidden Files. She's going to bring us a little bit more information about other situations taking place since October the 7th. Well, Maryam, welcome to the Hidden Files team. It's a pleasure having you on board.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure being part of this team.
Well, I'd like to look at, because outside of the Palestinian territories, there were other situations taking place that has had a big effect. Tell us about that.
Yes, of course. So now what happened is that in bombing Gaza indiscriminately, the Israeli regime didn't just destroy Palestinian homes, schools, and hospitals. It also destroyed the widely believed myth that the international law was created to defend the rights of oppressed nations, and therefore there's no need for armed resistance. Now, today, this law has no real legitimacy and power in the eyes of millions who have seen Palestinian parents pull out the bodies of their children from under the rubble in the deafening silence of the so-called international community.
It's often said that one man's terrorist is another's freedom fighter. Well, in this case, one colonialist terrorist is a nation's resistance fighter, and this has held true throughout history, where indigenous peoples, like Palestinians, were invaded using lethal weapons, stripped of their lands, using legal weapons and documents, and portrayed as the perpetrators of using the weapon of media. But there's one thing these powers cannot win without your consent. And that is the control of your mind. So next time they ask you to condemn those fighting against colonial interests, maybe let them know that you have read their history. Goodbye for me, Marzieh Hashemi, and from the whole crew right here in the studio.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pastoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
Lullaby, my darling, lullaby, my son, sleep in peace, sleep in silence. I've dug the earth with my hands, my bare hands. I've searched for my roots in this soil, this holy land, the land which is yours and which is mine, Palestine. And you, good earth, glorious land, now I offer my son to you. See, I offer my son to you, only to you. I lifted his head from his mother's arms. I put him on your chest, still in my roots, Palestine, 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 lullaby, my child, sleep in peace, sleep in silence. Since the story of my anger and your blood, the story of our mother's tears and your brother's cry, have to take us on, have to take us on. Lullaby, my darling, lullaby, my dear, sleep in peace, sleep in silence. Since somebody inside my aching heart, somebody inside our land, our blood joins in sacrifice, sacrifice. Your blood roots we hear, this land.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The headlines this hour. Israel presses ahead with its relentless airstrikes and shelling of the besieged Gaza Strip as the death toll from the